All right, once again, it's Going Down podcast. Today, we have another recording from the Revolutionary Organizing Against Racism Conference, or the ROAR Conference, that took place in March in Oakland and San Francisco. On today's program, we're going to have a recording from the General Defense Committee of the Industrial Workers of the World. We have two organizers that are going to talk about how they went from a small group of around 20 to right now around 100 people. So if you want to listen to a program about anarchists that are getting organized in their city and how they're growing beyond just a small group of people into a larger network or fighting force, hopefully this recording has some good ideas that you can take away and use where you live. And again, if you enjoy It's Going Down, if you're one of the thousands of people that use it every single day as a resource, please log on, donate. We need to meet our monthly goal. We need your help to do it. Please help us out. Thanks a lot for listening. Let's get into it.
Great. Cool, we're going to get started. My name's Stephanie B. This is my comrade Max. We're from the Twin Cities IWW branch, and we're here to really talk about our General Defense Committee. So we do, we're here to talk about community self-defense and how we've developed it in the Twin Cities. So just some quick stuff about myself. I joined the IWW when I found out they were prison organizing, and I was in a prison abolition group, and I was pretty impressed by some of the work that Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee was doing. Myself and a couple other black anarchists joined the IWW and formed the African People's Caucus to push the IWW towards a more black liberatory politic, and also to develop militant organizers of African descent in the Twin Cities. So we do political education. But really, we are here to talk about the General Defense Committee, and I'm on a number of committees that we'll talk about. But for those who don't know, the IWW is a radical anti-capitalist union. A number of people in this room are with us. And we focus on direct action-based organizing. We really see ourselves different from the, you know, business unions that are working with bosses that are, you know, suppressing labor activity and labor uprising. So, and also we have a really radical stance. You know, we don't allow cops in our union. We, you know, stand with workers that, you know, we're always in opposition to the AFL-CIO. We really set ourselves apart from those other, like, weak-ass unions that are, like, not really representing workers' interests, so.
Yeah, my name is Max. I work with Stephanie in IWOC, which is the prisoner organizing group. I'm also an after-school teacher, and I've worked a lot with the Twin Cities Education Workers Committee. Also, for West Coasters who might not know the Midwest, Twin Cities implies Minneapolis and St. Paul, which are two cities in St. Paul that are across the Mississippi from each other. So our IWW and GDC covers both of those. Both of those cities. And just to give like a very, very cursory intro to the IWW and the GDC, the GDC is kind of a new formation within the IWW, at least as it exists now. Radical anti-capitalist working class based organizing that happens in the workplace happens within the IWW proper. And then the GDC is kind of the community organizing wing of the IWW. So if you're doing organizing against police brutality or, you know, for tenants unions or something like that, that kind of stuff, there's now a place for that within the IWW and within the GDC. And we'll talk a little bit later about the kind of strengths and advantages of having all this stuff going on in a single organization.
Yeah, so we're going to start off with some of the bigger things we've done over the past 2 years. We're going to go over how we went from 10 people in 2015 that were doing like labor or that were doing like legal defense for union members to 130 members that are doing all kinds of amazing organizing in the Twin Cities. So Max is going to highlight some of our high points of the last 2 years, and then we'll give you some background into like how we got where we're at now and then where we see the future and how we want to spread this idea to all of you and everybody and the world. So yeah, go.
So a brief list of some of the things we've been proud to accomplish. Some police in Minneapolis shot through a car of high school students. Luckily nobody was hit, but that was a reason for outrage. And through the GDC's efforts and working alongside the families and the kids themselves, we got a $150,000 settlement for the kids and their families. No lawyers, no going through the legal system. We just held our own press releases, held our own protests. A month later, $150,000. So you think that's a kind of example of what direct action can do. There was a proposed prison in the Twin Cities that was going to cost $40 million and house youth. And through, again, same thing, direct action, we stopped a $40 million youth prison from being built in the Twin Cities. There's been a network that's kind of sprouted up independently of the GDC, but has since been kind of integrated into the GDC, of a sexual survivor support accountability network. So people that do teams of kind of create like these accountability pods and teams that do work around kind of accountability around rape and kicking abusers that are not being accountable out of certain spaces, stuff like that. There's been a resurgence of a long defunct group, a drug users support group. Insofar as drug users are abused by the state in all sorts of ways, some of our members, Stephanie included, have restarted a drug user support group. So instead of just focusing on abstinence, they focus on support for drug users in ways that does not just shame and just attack them in all sorts of ways. Lastly, one of our more kind of protectory anti-fascist work. There's a number of fascist bands that tour throughout the country, and we've done a lot of intel and research on them and have started kicking them out of Twin Cities venues. So when they come to town, we either target the venue to get the venue to cancel the show, or if they still show up, then we show up to the shows ourselves and kick out the fascists when they show up. The talk is mostly going to focus on kind of like the philosophical underpinning of our approach. Then we're going to go into kind of the history and how we came to where we are today and how it informs our work. And then kind of end on just conversation with everybody here about what kind of community self-defense work they see themselves doing in this current moment. I laughed at what was said. I've been misled. Confusing my enemy. Smile. obviously this is, well, maybe not as obvious, maybe it's not obvious, but this is the kind of defense that the GDC envisions. To kind of try to sum it up in simple words, we are here for the physical, emotional, financial, political defense of the working class. And anything that tries to threaten the working class in any of those ways is stuff that we're defending against and fighting against. And yeah, it's important to talk about fascism in terms of the working class, because that's one of the, especially today, one of the lead, one of the major aggressors of the working class. It's not everybody is that's attacking the working class is, fits the strict definition of a fascist, but in terms of things like white supremacy, totalitarianism, these are things that have various embodiments that all together are attacking the working class. So fascism grows when people are given false solutions and when liberalism fails. So when we're given, especially like certain politicians that we need to line up behind, and they get into power, even if they don't get into power, but we all put our hope into them, and those politicians fail to get elected, or when they do get elected, their policies fail. So we have things like Clinton, Bush, Obama passing free trade policies that devastate the working class. You have things like deportation of immigrants that, again, the last, you know, probably every president actually has been pretty consistent on. And what the the GDC, what we try to do is we try to offer solutions, essentially spreading the message that people have the power to change things themselves and they don't have to look outside themselves to political parties or to the state or to nonprofits to change their material conditions and defend themselves against whatever attacks they're faced up against. One note that was written in this training by somebody else is that self-defense is not just punching Nazis. And yeah, sometimes when we get on this stuff, people think that that's all we're about. But yeah, here I want to kind of delve quickly into the kind of work the GDC does as a mass-oriented organization and the kind of stuff that we encourage people to do outside of the GDC. Every once in a while, Nazi gets punched. It's really great. Richard Spencer, you know, stuff like that. And the GDC, we think punching Nazis is cool, but we don't do that within our work as an organization itself for a number of reasons that I want to go into. First of all, we're not going to get into the technical details of the GDC's, you know, financial structure or anything. The GDC is a really easy organization to join. Anybody who's in the working class or identifies with it basically can join the GDC. And because of that, that gives us our mass orientation. We're a group for everybody in the working class. The flip side is that if somebody were to join the group who wasn't really down with us, or, you know, informants from the far right or for the police, if they were to come into our organization and we were doing things like punching Nazis or attacking people physically that were attacking the working class, that would put us on bad ground with the state, because that would be a way for the state to not only destroy our organization and arrest certain people, but it would give them the means to shut down our entire organization, freeze our bank accounts, raid our offices, stuff like that. So the GDC, we don't do stuff we do some illegal stuff, like, you know, march down the streets and shit, but we don't do higher level illegal stuff that will get our organization shut down as a whole. If people want to do that, we don't discourage that. We're not nonviolent. We're not apostles of nonviolence. We think that if people want to resist fascism in whatever ways they want to, they should. And we encourage people to do that, but they should do it alongside or outside of the GDC proper, because that repression is going to come out on this organization organizationally and shut off our ability to resist and defend the working class. The second reason is that with a mass orientation, we want everybody, kids, their grandmas, you know, everybody to be able to participate in the GDC and in most of what we do. So not everybody's necessarily going to mask up and go up and punch Nazis. And so, again, we encourage that, but the GDC is a mass-oriented group. We are focused on things that the entire working class can get involved in. And so, kind of, what does mass anti-fascism look like? I'll give an example. In the Twin Cities, we got some intel that some fascists were coming into our big art museum, the Minneapolis Institute of Arts, a few weeks ago, and they were going to go into the European art section and start handing out flyers about, you know, white supremacy, the white race, shit like that. And so we held a rally outside, handed out flyers, drowned out the fascists that did approach us. and basically tell the community, look, there's fascists organizing in communities. This is especially a community with a lot of immigrants, for example. And we think if the community is aware of what's going on, the resistance will grow and people will get involved in mass resistance. Alongside that, some people wanted to confront these fascists at a little higher level. Outside of the GDC, they went into the museum and physically removed the fascists from the area using whatever means they felt necessary. But again, this is how kind of mass anti-fascism can work alongside different approaches to mass to anti-fascism. And we think that both are really important. But in the GDC specifically, we're involved in mass work. So, yeah. Somebody said mutual aid earlier, and I want to speak to that, especially how it's connected to dual power. It's part of the IWW preambles that the IWW seeks to build the new world in the shell of the old. And so I can give a couple examples of how the GDC is trying to do this. So sexual assault survivor support. If somebody experiences sexual violence, society and the state encourages to work through the state, work through the courts, call the police, stuff like that. Again, in some circumstances that are extreme, that might be somewhat appropriate, but we think that there's a lot of problems with that, so we're providing our own networks, our own systems, our own processes for people to be able to come together collectively, not be isolated by the court system and by the police and whoever, to basically solve this ourselves, because sexual violence is a community problem. We've got to figure out ways to solve it without relying on the state. Another example is the harm reduction stuff. How can drug users basically exercise their own self-determination without being railroaded through abstinence-only programs or religious programs that stigmatize, destroy their opportunities for growth and self-determination? So we have Steph will speak to this more later, but programs where drug users come together and support each other and figure out ways to be healthy together.
There is an example that somebody came to an activist that had been raped by another activist, had to avoid a lot of leftist spaces in Minneapolis for 2 years, and finally got sick of it and decided to kind of reach out to other feminists and other activists. Survivor organizations that were doing that kind of work, and they stumbled upon this pod model that is basically a crew of your close friends or people that you can trust. It could be 3 people, it could be 5, it could be 7, whoever you're ready to, who you trust that's ready to take on this issue, and then they kind of strategize and develop either some sort of method for them to see justice however they want to see it as a group, or it's just providing support, maybe doing weekly support groups with that person, looking for housing for that person, looking for, ways to alternative routes to and from school or that kind of thing. It's just building a support network. So they started with a pod of about 7 of us or so, but then they wrote to a ton of organizations in the Twin Cities and bookstores and radical collectives. And also the person who was accused is in the bike community. So they wrote to all the bike shops and bike collectives and basically said, hey, I was raped by a member of your collective or your volunteer at your bookstore, yada, yada. How does your organization handle sexual assault? And kind of called all those organizations to task and said, how do you deal with this, called employers, all that, and asked for this community response meeting. We set this meeting. This is all on Unicorn Riot, by the way. You can watch the whole video of how it went down. It ended up being like 50, 60 people that gathered in support of this one person. They had organized to wrote a letter to the person that was accused and said, you're being, we want to hold you accountable for this. This whole community, including bikers, radical leftists, blah, 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 we want to see justice for this person and justice for yourself or whatever. And so you can bring 2 witnesses and come to the park so we can finish this whole thing. The person showed up. The survivor read a list of demands that themselves and the pod that they came up with as a group. And those basic demands are, basically, we want you off of this collective. We don't want you in this space. We don't want you in this bookstore, blah, blah, blah. I want to exist in the Minneapolis kind of scene again as a person. And they signed the list of demands, and that was it. So it was just an incredibly powerful thing that I've never seen before in my life. They initially went to the police, and the police gave them the whole, like, oh, you are drunk, or you were wearing whatever story that they always do. So they came instead to their own community. And a lot of the people who were on the hill that day with, you know, standing beside that survivor were GDC members. So they found it appropriate to take that work into the GDC and create a working group within the GDC. So now they've had other survivors come tell their stories and form pods and do actions. So that's just one small example. I don't have a ton of other answers, and it's a really new working group, but it's something. So, and we have tons of working groups we'll talk about, but yeah. So you can go to Unicorn Riot, and just, that's the media collective that documented it. Just type sexual assault survivor, Unicorn Riot. Yeah. So, something that Max was talking about was kind of this idea of mutual aid and dual power. Mutual aid, we wanted to see justice for the survivor, so we all participated, because if something like that were to happen to me, I would want a pod and a crew of people to back me up. So that's why we do these things for each other. If you've ever heard the term solidarity unionism, it's a similar idea. Most unions operate based on craft, like you got your cabinet makers and your food service workers and blah, 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 blah. But they often pit workers against each other. In the IWW, we organize across all different industries. That's why we're one big union, including incarcerated people, sex workers, so on and so forth. Anybody who wants to join that's part of the working class can join, because we believe that our struggles are all tied to each other. And I don't want to compete with you as a laborer. I want to struggle alongside of you so that we can all elevate our conditions as workers. So what that looks like is, whereas the AFL-CIO said, oh, Standing Rock, well, we support the No Dapple because jobs, the IWW's standpoint was, no, fuck those jobs, because an injury to one is an injury to all. An injury to one Indigenous person is an injury to all. So instead of doing the, oh, jobs, oh my God, union, yay thing, we have some radical electricians that went to Standing Rock to install solar panels for the camp. That's an idea. That's an example of solidarity unionism. A couple more, that youth prison blockade that Max was talking about, where the state is like, oh, we're going to build this new youth facility, it's going to be great, it's going to have so many cages, rooms, or whatever they call it. They call it beds, but they're cages. They're going to have so many beds, and it's going to be so, you know, great for the community. Well, so the social justice educators got together with GDC members and with incarcerated workers organizing committee. These three committees got together and said, we oppose this prison, we ran this campaign. So that's another example of solidarity unionism. The other one that's really cool that happened in Minneapolis was during Ferguson. After Mike Brown got killed, there was this action organized by UPS workers called Hands Up, Don't Ship, if you've heard of it. They started this campaign. They found out that these racially biased tactical targets were getting sent to Ferguson police. So they were like, there were these targets that had, like, you know, thug, like, stereotypes on it, and police were using them for their tactical training, for their arm training. And UPS workers found out about it, said an injury to one is an injury to all, what the fuck, and decided to organize a small campaign where they were going to do a direct action and hold those and not ship those tactical targets. So they did a social media thing. They spread the hashtag, hands up, don't ship. They wrote a letter to the residents of Ferguson and said, you know, we heard what happened about Mike Brown. We don't want to contribute to this racist police system that's, you know, causing these deaths. We're going to try our best to withhold these racist tactical targets. So what happened was they held them for a couple hours. UPS had to reroute all of them. So it cost UPS money to do that. So that's an example of solidarity unionism. We're always thinking in the IWW, what if you could organize the workers? What if you could organize the workers? And so we apply that idea to the community self-defense stuff. So in the IWW, like we might have a shop campaign, like Starbucks or Jimmy John's or Ellen Stardust. In the GDC, we started all these working groups that are kind of issue-based right now. So that's why we have the harm reduction campaign. We have the sexual assault survivors working group. We have information security. We'll get into all of them, but that it's about direct democracy, independence, direct action. And they reject these ideas of like social peace. Social peace is what the police want when they try to quell all the uprisings that are going on in Ferguson, Baltimore, Minneapolis, wherever. There's also labor peace, which is what happens when your bosses hire union busting firms or your bosses say, oh, everything's fine. We're going to give you a nickel raise and it's going to be great. So the IWW and the GDC are against social peace just for, you know, status quo's sake. If the people want to rise up, we like that. So Max is going to get into the history of the GDC and how we got to where we're at, because it's kind of rich and awesome.
Yeah. One last point I wanted to write up here about solidarity unionism is kind of taking the idea of solidarity unionism and extending it beyond the workplace. So, yeah, that's kind of implied. Just wanted to restate it. Into the community. The GDC was originally founded in 1917. A bunch of Wobblies back then were going on strike.
What's a Wobbly, Max?
Sorry.
Wobblies are a slang for members of the IWW. So Wobblies in 1917 were going on strike for better working conditions, but that was in the middle of World War One. So the President Wilson was cracking down hard on that to, you know, preserve the war economy. As well as Wobblies, a lot of Wobblies were on the front lines of speaking out against World War One, and because of that, Wobblies were being thrown in jail en masse, just basically to get rid of them, to keep the economy going and stop destruction of the war. And so the GDC kind of was started as a legal defense fund for workers who were being thrown in jail, specifically political workers who were doing poor organizing. I want to kind of draw out, that was kind of how the GDC started. I want to draw out a few other examples of kind of inspiration that the Twin Cities GDC takes. In 1934 was a big year of labor strikes across the country. Minneapolis was one of three cities, the other one being San Francisco and Tulsa, where there was kind of like probably the most labor unrest in U.S. history happened in 1934, specifically in those three cities. And each city kind of had various approximations of a general strike at various times throughout the year. In Minneapolis, the Teamsters, the truckers, went on strike. And Minneapolis at the time was an extremely anti-union town. And a bunch of radical labor organizers were trying to bring unions, specifically socialist unions, into Minneapolis. And the Teamsters were not a socialist union, but the local Teamsters union in the Twin Cities was controlled by basically socialists and former IWW members. When they went on strike, they basically tried to stop the shipment of all goods in the city, stopped all trucks from moving. So anything that would need to depends on trucks in the city was essentially halted for various times throughout the year, which again is pretty much all goods. And when they did that, the employers in town hired thugs to basically attack the pickets. And so in response, the Teamsters set up their own workers' defense guards to basically protect picketing workers from assaults by thugs and deputized anti-union thugs. So that's kind of another like, area of inspiration for us. Another one is a bunch of punks in the 80s were doing anti-fascist work. They called themselves the Baldies. We've got a Baldy right here. Some of our current members are come from those days as well. And they pushed fascists out of the Twin Cities. That group eventually kind of transitioned into a group called Anti-Racist Action, which I think is the name of the group that's officially putting this conference on. Anti-Racist Action was founded first in the Twin Cities, Minneapolis, in the later 80s, and it kind of developed over the years from not being just an anti-fascist group, but kind of developed a more political analysis around anti-capitalism and feminism and a whole kind of like cluster of other political subjects. So that's kind of another big part of our history and our influence. And more recently, when the IWW in the Twin Cities started up in 2006, two different occasions, IWW members were either on strike themselves or supporting other strikers, and were walking on picket lines. And in the course of 1 week, two IWW members got hit by cars on picket lines from cars that were trying to drive through crowds of protesting workers. And when that happened, it was a real wake-up call. Like, we're not able to defend ourselves physically from attacks from various reactionary forces. If we're getting run over by cars and picket lines, how can we possibly strive for better conditions at the workplace? So through that, we developed a picket training, which is basically just a much more disciplined, organized way for us to run labor pickets, so that we can basically, instead of relying on other bureaucratic labor unions to provide physical and financial and legal defense for us, we do all that in-house now, because we don't, when one of our members got hit by a car, crushed three bones in his spine, this was at a, AFSCME was the local at this particular protest site, and they said they had witnesses and the license plate number and all that stuff, and they were going to get to the IWW after the fact, but 2 days later, we were calling them to get this information, they said it disappeared. And the reason that people think that they did that is because they kind of had a cushy relationship with the university where the workers were on strike at, and that the labor union did not want to ruffle the feathers. They wanted to be, they wanted to play it nice with the university to try to get a kind of like a sweetheart contract. And so when I remember I hit by a car, we got screwed over because we weren't able to provide our own defense of our own workers. Some other work that kind of predated the current formation of the GDC is anti-fascist work. So kind of like more mass-based anti-fascist work. So there's some Nazis that were doing kind of like role-playing parties in a bar in the Twin Cities. And so we started showing up to that bar and holding rallies outside and got those people pushed out of that bar. And there's various other examples of us doing that in the recent past. And then what really formed the GDC as it is today is something Seth's gonna talk about now.
Yeah. A couple other things though too, like we've had incidents of white supremacists shooting at Black Lives Matter protesters. This fellow worker in Seattle was just shot by Trump supporters. So this is something we've all probably been thinking about. So this is just why we're starting a crisis management manual and why we've amped up our picket and martial training and why we've spread picket and martial training beyond just labor picket lines to direct actions and mass demonstrations. So a lot of our work ends up being alongside, we've all participated in Black Lives Matter rallies and protests and beyond, and before that, I mean, since Trayvon and all of that, we've been participating. But now we're stepping it up in this way of like, we're doing our own security and we're providing people with the tools to be able to have demonstrations and not be worried that like, you know, some shit's gonna go down. So I'm gonna try to run through it quickly about the shooting of Jamar Clark in Minneapolis, the occupation of the 4th Precinct, police precinct there. I'm sure a lot of you have heard the story. I'm not going to tell the entire story because another GDC member wrote a 16-page story on it. So if you want more details about the 4th Precinct, again, see me afterwards. So a little background. Jamar Clark was a black teenager who was shot in 2015 in Minneapolis by police. They were responding to a domestic incident and mental health crisis. They shot and killed him within 1 minute of showing up. So he had no chance. This was in a poor black neighborhood in North Minneapolis. So Black Lives Matter protesters, community members, everybody got together because we were pissed off and we were in North Minneapolis, and Black Lives Matter decided we're gonna occupy that police precinct in North Minneapolis down the street from where the brother was shot. We occupied that precinct for a, not, we didn't go inside. Sorry, I say occupy the precinct. Occupied the outer entryway to the precinct. We occupied there for 18 days, so it was pretty intense. A lot of different dynamics broke out between the group of people who were occupying. So, and if you want to write, because it's so it's clear. I'm going to try to not be redundant, but it's pretty important. I'm going to say activists and nonprofits a bunch in the story. I mean it pejoratively in this story, and I don't mean that all activists or nonprofits are bad or bad people. I'm saying in this instance, there was some stuff that went down that wasn't so great. So activists, nonprofits kind of were college students, liberal, nonprofit scene. Black Lives Matter Minneapolis, there's a Black Lives Matter St. Paul, there's two groups. Minneapolis is kind of the official chartered like BLM organization. I believe they have nonprofit status at this point. They came out of Take Action Minnesota, which was a Democratic Party think tank on legislative reform stuff. So that's kind of where they came from and brought a lot of activists from. NOC is an organization called Neighborhoods Organizing for Change. They do great work in North Minneapolis, but they're increasingly doing Democratic Party politics. NAACP, same story in Minneapolis. Good stuff occasionally, but increasingly just doing Democratic Party kind of reform stuff. So these people, the nonprofits, activists, a lot of them were Black, but they were college students. These people were not too militant. Community members, people from the hood, working class Black people were very, very militant, obviously, because they got to protect their shit. That's their neighborhood. And if you're from the hood, you understand what it's like to be under occupation by the police all the time. You go to the gas station, there's two squad cars there, six pigs inside watching everything you do. This is constant. That's a constant thing in North Minneapolis that these people weren't ready for. They also weren't ready for the class dynamics of North Minneapolis, of the hood. It's really complicated when you have a community of activists. Sure, we're working together for common cause, but if you don't have a good class analysis, you're going to miss out on why people do the things they do, and you're going to make all these biased assumptions, and it's going to be bad. So, for example, these two cousins of Jamar Clark were really frustrated that the Unitarian Church was there doing their thing. They were in this big circle singing for way too long. And so these two brothers that had just had their cousin shot by police got pissed off and tired of the singing. They started singing that one, I keep forgetting it. It's a song that was written by somebody who was pro-slavery.
Amazing Grace.
Thank you. I've been telling this story all week and I keep forgetting. Amazing Grace. The Unitarian Church started singing Amazing Grace. Everybody got pissed. So then it's just Black folks screaming at Unitarians. It was awkward. I felt terrible, but it needed to happen because, like, shut the fuck up. Like, right? Like, nobody wants to hear this right now. Their main point was we're tired of singing. We want to take some actions. We've been in the streets all night. This is exhausting. And also, you're taking up too much space kind of thing. So there was that story. There was one point where this brother, Marcel, who was targeted by the state and that kind of thing often, he had told us all how he had been shot by police. His kids were being taken away by the state, so on and so forth. He was probably one of the most militant people there. There was at one point, after he was like crying and screaming and talking to us on the side, like all of BLM Minneapolis had this circle around him, and it was super awkward. Like people were trying to touch him and grab him, and he was like shaking, and they were like screaming like, "We love you." Like it was the most terrifying, like gross thing I'd seen, in a long time. So, the police started kicking people out at night. They would come through, try to raid the camp. So that's another critique I have. These folks are here during the day in front of the cameras, right? All the activists are doing their thing. They're talking about how awful it is and how we gotta, you know, prosecute the police or whatever. But then at night, when the pigs come out, they're targeting the community. Those people are long gone. They're in bed with they're back home in the suburbs, sleep, peace, all that. And then the only people who are left are community members and Wobblies were like on the front lines. So I was really proud of IWW and soon to be GDC members, because where this community of people were, activists set up like rules for the space that the people in the community fell outside of the parameters of all the time. So no drinking, no, like I watched this kid get yelled at for saying nigga, like there was no smoking weed, all this. And then it's like, well, where does the hood kick it? Because this is where we always kick it. But now the nonprofits have taken over, right? So it was really, really not, it was not cool. But those folks that were deemed too macho, too violent, too angry or whatever, you know, the kind of respectability politics that these kind of nonprofit folks and activists kind of pushed on folks, those were the people that were most militant. Those were the ones that IWW members and myself and GDC members, and you know, we were working together, we were strategizing, we were telling stories. Most of my time wasn't spent on the main part of the occupation. It was spent on the side streets, smoking weed in cars with people, having conversations about the police and about day-to-day life in North Minneapolis and about what it's like to be under consistent occupation. So building those relationships were so important. And I was amazed by the fact that, you know, you see these, we're struggling together against the police, because IWW members have this class analysis that is really important and can allow people to understand why they need to lash out or why they feel the need to throw a bottle back at police who are pepper spraying their kids or whatever. I promise you, first of all, gang members were on the front lines. They already know how to hold down the hood. I promise you that. We knew who had guns that brought them to the corners to protect and just stand there. You know, I'm armed. Everybody in the hood knows who's armed. But the community knows how to fight back against police that are pepper spraying and shooting marker rounds and trolling around in those white vans just looking for people to snatch and grab. The community found all kinds of ways to fight back using the basic materials you find on the block, right? So building all kinds of barricades, protecting themselves. There were parts where we had to run into people's apartments just to keep the heat off of us from the police because they were just so hot and heavy. And people were super cool about like, hey, sis, come here. Let's go in here real quick. And so it was, those were the dynamics. And there wasn't this idea of, like, even for all the shit that the activists kind of put this community through, they weren't even upset about it. They were just glad that people were there supporting however they could. So, you know, there were, you know, people were just, I mean, the people we invited back to the IWW office were really grateful that they were being listened to at all, because the activists kind of, I heard so many people get called, oh, he's just crazy. Oh, he's just drunk. Oh, he's just stoned. I heard that happen so often. It was just disgusting. So those are the people that were like, you know, we want to listen to them because nobody else is listening to them yet. It's their neighborhood. So we invite them back to strategize. What do you want to do? What do you want to see for your neighborhood? How do you want to see justice? And, you know, the people shouting prosecute the police were not the community members. They know that that's not going to happen. They know that prosecution of the police is kind of this lofty idea that people have. And it's, yeah, you know, so they knew that the only way to see anything happen was to physically defend their space and to get rid of security cameras and do whatever it takes to like keep the police away. So that's all I'm gonna say about that. There were a couple other things that happened that are important. Like I said, at one point, a bunch of white dudes on 4chan it's not even a bunch of white dudes. Two white dudes, a Hispanic dude, and I think a woman got together on 4chan and decided we're white supremacists. We're gonna go shoot at these protesters. So they did that. They got off the internet. They came together and decided to shoot at 5 Black Lives Matter protesters. That shook things up in an insane way. That's why we're thinking about community self-defense. There was a lot of co-optation, like I said, in the media. All you saw was BLM Minneapolis, but those organizers were not the ones who were kind of on the front lines Same thing with two people went on to build political careers. They went on to run for city council off of this struggle, which is frustrating. And then, like I said, there was just that list of rules to create, to control the space that people that don't have maybe a good class analysis might not understand, you know, like what, you know, how people in the hood act. We learned a lot of lessons from it. We learned a lot about kind of some of the liberal identity politics that were at play. There's kind of this idea that like white allies should just follow like black leadership, but oftentimes that black leadership ends up being college, well-educated, well-dressed, well-spoken. So it's kind of unfair to say, oh, well, I'm just a white ally, I follow black leadership, as if we're all the same kind of monolith. And, you know, how come you won't follow, you know, the brother that actually, you know, like would not let a cop car through that zone? You know, you wouldn't follow him, but you'll follow the kids that are singing because it's comfortable. So it's comfortable as an ally to follow the most comfortable shit that you're used to. And then also like the demonizing of militancy, you know, people that are, oh, well, you're just making everything worse. Well, no, the police are always the ones that are the actors, right? And then there's always, there's the kind of, it's rhetoric that I understand why people use it, but it's a little misguided, the kind of white anarchist and outside agitator rhetoric that the state used, and then the next day the police chief said it herself. She said, oh yeah, the white anarchists came, they ruined everything, they broke everything, it was bad. The problem with that is, I promise you, I don't ever need a white anarchist in my life to defend myself from the police. I got it. I'm good. That's my issue with that whole line. Also, the outside agitator thing, Mumia does a great talk about that you should look up on your own time. And we should definitely recognize how some people have power and some people don't. And then at the same time, I would rather build up so that we as a black community can come together and act on our own behalf and like fuck the privilege that, you know, those folks have. I don't even want
that's
the privilege.
That's paternalistic, I get it.
Yeah, I don't want the privilege that this white dude has, because in my eyes and in the eyes of the police and the state, he doesn't even have too much privilege these days. So there is a little bit, so you know what I mean? That is a dynamic that's important, because I roll with white anarchists that have principles. And I know there's some people that call themselves anarchists in the world, but I'm not so sure sometimes. So anyway, that's a whole long conversation for another time. We form solidarity through struggle and shared, you know, we had a shared vision. And we know that in a police occupation that could happen in Ferguson, can happen in Baltimore, can happen in Minneapolis, can happen in Bakersfield. We were talking to people yesterday. This police problem is widespread. So we formed struggle that way. We developed class analysis. And we rejected these respectability politics that a lot of people put on that community. So the same tactic kind of happened after Philando Castile got shot by police, but this was in a completely different neighborhood. They occupied the governor's mansion in St. Paul. That was a white college neighborhood, a little bit different. By that time, the major players here in the BLM Minneapolis, lead organizers, the NAACP, all those large, large nonprofits and organizations, they got to doing Bernie Sanders shit. So they really faded back. They really faded into the background by the time Philando Castile, that struggle was popping off. So this opened up some space for ourselves to grow, other grassroots organizations, the Twin Cities Coalition for Justice for Jamar, that was free of this nonprofit status, came and they pressured the state for weeks throughout the winter. And they did these Freeman Fridays, they were marching the prosecutor. It's not really the tactics I would use, but they were putting in work while all the flashy, you know, nonprofit folks were busy like doing Bernie Sanders stuff. So that was really frustrating for us to see, but it also allowed us room to shake, move, flex. We started having our own events. GDC started having our own things with our own politics. We shut down a liquor store that was owned by the city that Philando Castile was shot in. We exposed the police chief for being in a white supremacist tied motorcycle gang, shit like that that the GDC did to put our politics on the map. There was a question, and then Max is going to close us out with like our working groups and our structure and where we grew from there. So survival's number one all the time, I would say. I think we have to, if we don't get our basic needs met, we're finished. I put forming relationships and building solidarity, I put that at a little higher priority, I think a lot of us do, than tactical arguments. A lot of us did not agree with the occupation of the 4th Precinct, but it was happening anyway, and to argue against it at the time just didn't seem like a good use of our time. Instead of arguing against the tactic of occupation, we were like, no, let's get to know these people in the hood. That's what matters the most. So, and we did have plenty of arguments and coming to terms with other groups. So that's important too. Yeah. We got that influx of people because we have a lot of activity going on, and we got a lot of people that were interested in self-defense for a number of different reasons. So instead of just having this narrow, like, kind of like, oh, we just want to do like physical self-defense, or oh, we just want to do anti-police brutality, we opened up this space where all kinds of people can come in and do defense work. And so that's, and also having that mass orientation, focusing on the entire working class, is how we got a lot. So, but I really want to let Max go because I think he's going to answer a lot of your questions here in a minute.
So kind of what Steph was alluding to is that we, for what, during the 4th Precinct, the GDC was basically the anti-police brutality wing of the IWW. That was what we were doing. After the 4th Precinct kind of settled down more, we started figuring out we want to defend the communities in more ways than just from the police, from just police brutality. And so going into all the other things that we were talking about, like drug users, sexual assault, stuff like that. At that point, we turned the GDC into more of an umbrella organization that would have working groups within it that would address many different issues. So all the different issues that we talked about lie within the GDC, which acts as kind of like an umbrella. And to kind of answer the question of like how we sustained that growth, partly it's because we did have all these working groups, but part of it's too is that we had, just through our activity within the 4th Precinct struggles, and kind of before that even, we had built a reputation in the Twin Cities. People knew we were about stuff because we turned out, we did actions. So we got a lot of, I feel like a lot of the best organizers in the Twin Cities started hanging around us. And kind of, we had this pool of really amazing people that started to, hang out with us and like do work with us. And also this should go alongside of that the GDC and the Twin Cities formed alongside the already existing IWW. The Twin Cities happens to have one of the largest IWW branches in the country. So we had a lot of infrastructure in place. So when, you know, literally hundreds of people, or up to like 140 members now, started flooding into our organization, we can kind of borrow the same organizational infrastructure that the IWW had and kind of copy that wholesale into the GDC. So kind of like all that stuff you were talking about with, solidarity unionism, direct action, direct democracy, all that kind of stuff. We have similar organizational structures in the GDC and the IWW. And so we just had this kind of model right there for us that we were able to borrow and carry over into the GDC that gave us the kind of organizational infrastructure that I think a lot of radical groups do struggle with when they get past 20. Oh, we get past 20 people, we've never been in an organization this big, or we've never administered an all-volunteer organization that big. How do you do it? And we had the benefit of kind of doing community organizing alongside the existing really strong framework of labor organizing. Kind of going along with what's more the default in movements, but it's increasingly changing as some of the product people have talked about. But it's really easy to work within an organization that works on one or two issues. There's a lot of power in that. You can stay focused. When you build alliances with other groups, you're working on, you have certain unity around the issues you're working on. But I want to note the strengths of putting a lot of political projects underneath a single umbrella. For example, youth prison blockade, when we stopped that youth prison that was being built, it was a coalition within the IW and the GDC between prison support organizers, between radical teachers, and between radical youth, and between GDC members who were doing anti-police brutality activism. And that's the kind of coalition that would take a lot more work to pull off if we were all in separate organizations around the city with totally separate, totally different politics. Within one organization, we're able to unite our approaches in a way that I've never experienced before, but it's been extremely powerful. Yeah, and as we talk more about these working groups, and at the end of the talk, talk about like kind of future directions, this kind of cross-pollination between all these different issues, I think is like a real strength of the kind of organizing that's kind of emerging and all over the country, but in the Twin Cities, it's happening through the GEC. So Steph and I are just going to walk through really quickly the working groups that we have. And just to give an idea of some of the stuff that we've got going on and some of the kind of collaborations that we've been working on. I'm a member of the Physical Defense Working Group, so we do things like trainings and boxing, jujitsu, stuff like that. We provide trainings to our own members. We're also trying to create outward-facing trainings for the entire working class. They want to come and train with us. We want to offer these skills to, again, with a mass-based focus. We also want to use these skills not only for individual physical self-defense, like if you're afraid, if you belong to a group of people that might get targeted for hate attacks, but also we want to protect ourselves at Trump rallies, at anti-fascist rallies. We want to be able to protect ourselves collectively as well. Another group I'm part of is kind of speaking to that organizational infrastructure and skills. I'm part of the Member Engagement Committee working group. We just have so many people joining. We just need an entirely separate working group that's dedicated to introducing new people to all these different ideas, the overall politics, how the organization works, plugging them in. I'm a member of the training working group, which is kind of like with the physical defense stuff. We're trying to spread these skills not only to our own membership, but to the entire working class. So almost all these working groups are developing their own trainings that are integral to working class community self-defense. And this working group, the training working group, is kind of supporting different groups doing that kind of work. We've got a cop watch that kind of arose very directly out of the 4th Precinct work. Patrols the community, watches the interactions between cops and people. We've got information security, developing trainings on how to keep our organizational safe informationally, but individuals as well. Involved not only things like encryption and passwords, but kind of like more basic, like what kind of information do we talk about and where and how, and who is potentially seeking our vulnerable information? Are we defending our information against the far right, against the police? That kind of strategic thinking is something the information security working group has brought. And then we've got an anti-repression working group.
Jeez.
And this is the original function of the GDC, is just do legal support when our members are arrested, especially for community organizing and workplace organizing. We do a lot of heavy lifting for them in the courts.
We call this the OG working group because it's like the original function of the GDC. Yeah, a couple more that I'm involved in. Media publications is basic. It's graphic design stuff. You talked about info security, sexual assault survivors. I talked about a little bit. Does that make sense? I talked about that one. Harm reduction. We want to get into things like clean needle exchange, overdose prevention trainings. We restarted after years of not inaction. We restarted the Minneapolis Users Group, which is a weekly support group run by users for users. Yeah, we want to spread these ideas of support for alcohol and drug users inside of workplaces. I work at two bars, and it's rampant there, so I know a lot of people that can use this. Also, you can imagine the cross-pollination between harm reduction, cop watch, and incarcerated workers organizing committee. We have people in jail that get sent to halfway houses. I would like for them to know what the new drugs on the street are cut with. I'm going to go to harm reduction to get that information for them. So there's a lot of ways that these work together. We talked about Cop Watch. Anti-fascism is an intelligence gathering working group. We collect information on far-right threats in the Twin Cities. Hold
on to it to do what we want. And I think that's everything.
I don't mind stealing bread from the mouths of decadence, but I can't feed on the powerless when my cup's already farming, baby.